14. Hotel de Hamburg, 52 Rue Jacob, Paris, France, January 19, 1777, mid-morning. Benjamin Franklin is being watched. It is Sunday morning here in the small room serving as Franklin's temporary headquarters. As usual, the doctor rose at 5 a.m. for a leisurely 3-hour period of bathing, breakfast, and planning. He shaves himself rather than submit to the bad breath of a slovenly barber. Franklin will work until noon, then read or overlook my personal accounts and dine for 2 hours. In the afternoon, it is more work, then on to an evening of socializing before retiring to bed at 10 p.m. The schedule is intentionally selfish. Just 2 days ago, Franklin celebrated his 71st birthday, and this routine helps conserve his energy. The doctor is guarded, often cloaking himself in mystery even as his cult of celebrity in Paris society grows. The gray marten fur hat he wears at all times to keep his head warm has become so popular that many Parisian women try to emulate its appearance by forming their hair into the same shape, a hairstyle known as the coiffure à la Franklin. Local merchants are keen to make a profit from the eminent American's mysterious and sudden arrival in their city, much to Franklin's bemusement. "My picture is everywhere," Franklin writes home to his daughter Sally, "on the lids of snuff boxes, on rings, busts. The numbers sold are incredible. My portrait is a bestseller. You have prints and copies of prints and copies of copies spread everywhere. Your father's face is now as well known as the man in the moon." Footnote: 32-year-old Sarah Sally Franklin Bache lives in Philadelphia with her husband Richard, who served as the U.S. Postmaster General. She is the mother of 8 children and devotes her time to assisting with the war effort by sewing clothing for the troops. End footnote. Here on the Rue Jacob, Franklin is assisted by his illegitimate teenage grandson, Temple, who now serves as the doctor's social secretary. Franklin's other grandson, 7-year-old Benny, attends boarding school just outside the city in Passy, where he will learn to speak French so well that he will nearly forget his English. Footnote: on the left bank, Passy is well within the city's boundaries now, a short walk from the Eiffel Tower. Also on the left bank today, near the Square de Yorktown, is the Rue Benjamin Franklin. End footnote. Yet Franklin's fame does not come without a cost, which is why he now pens a response to a letter from Mrs. Juliana Ritchie, a Philadelphia expatriate in Paris, who recently paid him a social call. Franklin's desk is untidy, as it was on the day of her visit, with important papers spilling on top of one another. But it is Mrs. Ritchie's letter he focuses on. "You are surrounded with spies," her note warned, "who watch your every movement, who you visit, and by whom you are visited. Of the latter, there are those who pretend to be friends to the cause of your country, but that is a mere pretense." This is perhaps the most poorly kept secret in Paris, and Franklin is not the only citizen under observation. The French capital swarms with undercover agents. It is almost impossible for anyone of social status to go anywhere without his actions being scrutinized and reported. King Louis XVI, the 22-year-old monarch who has been seated on the throne of France for a mere 2 years, has thousands of official spies in his employ. Footnote: these figures are based upon an accounting of France's official registers published by French writer Louis-Pierre Manuel in 1792. In addition to the 6,000 spies in Paris, Manuel reported a figure of 19,300 official spies throughout all of France. Manuel, a French revolutionary who belatedly became a supporter of Louis XVI, was guillotined in Paris 1 year later for his loyalty to the king. End footnote. Political factions and organized crime networks throughout the city also use vast armies of snoops. Benjamin Franklin has been in Paris just a month, but he is already the subject of a police report. "Dr. Franklin, who lately arrived in this country from the English colonies, is very much run after and feted, the report states in bemused fashion. He has an agreeable physiognomy, spectacles always on his eyes, but little hair. A fur cap is always on his head. He wears no powder, but a neat air. Linen very white, and a brown coat makes his dress. His only defense is a stick in his hand. Footnote. Franklin's physical appearance was considered astonishing in Paris, for he seemed completely indifferent to the rigorous French code of dress, which included mandatory ruffled lace shirts, shoes with elaborate buckles, and white silk stockings. Many men and women often shaved their heads to avoid the constant threat of lice, donning wigs. Franklin's scalp was already mostly bald, but he made no attempt to groom his few remaining strands of hair. End footnote. Franklin's response to Mrs. Ritchie is intentionally comical and long overdue. The Paris mail arrives 9 times a day, but the doctor has waited a week to compose his letter. Jokingly, he promises that even if his personal valet was a spy, as probably he is, I think I should not discharge him for that, if in other respects I liked him. Franklin's attempt to mollify Mrs. Ritchie is sincere, but he would do well to heed her warning. For one of his closest friends and confidants is, in fact, a British spy, an agent of espionage so talented that his mission will not be publicly revealed for more than a century. The young man's name is George Bancroft, the same good friend and botanist whom Franklin once supported for election to the prestigious Royal Society, and who boldly supported him after the infamous hour of ridicule in the London cockpit in 1774. Believing Bancroft to be a man he can trust, Franklin personally requested that he be hired as secretary to the American delegation in Paris, responsible for handling all manner of diplomacy and sensitive paperwork. Big mistake. Within months, King George III will know the doctor's every move. Footnote. The website of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency makes note of Bancroft, saying, "What a spy he was. Bancroft was the asset that case officers and analysts today dream about." End footnote. Surrounded by spies, embraced by the temptations of Parisian society, and struggling to communicate in a language he is only now learning, Franklin comes to realize that his task will be neither quick nor simple, and that he may end up living in France for a very long time. Yet, as he takes up residence in a luxurious chateau on the outskirts of the city, and becomes more acquainted with some of the wealthiest widows and libertines of Paris, this thought troubles him less and less. Even as Franklin settles into Paris, though, a wealthy French teenager has decided to sail for America to join the rebellion. Indeed, he is so determined to fight that he spends more than 100,000 livres of his own money to purchase a vessel that will take him to the American Revolution. The teenager's name is Marie-Joseph-Paul-Yves-Roche-Gilbert-Dumontier, Marquis de Lafayette, or, as history will record him, Lafayette. The wealthy young Marquis is well connected in Europe and determined to make his reputation on the battlefields of America. In order to do that, he has to impress General George Washington, who is openly disdainful of European aristocrats. Upon meeting Lafayette in August 1777, Washington is polite but dismissive of his military desires. This will soon change.